Dr. George Dimitri, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
Over the past 5 years, 51% of all FDA-approved cancer drugs have had substantial input from Dana-Farber scientists and clinical investigators. And that comes from the culture here, the very basic curiosity-driven scientists that are probing really how cancer works.
At Dana-Farber, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
A lot of these bases that are out there are a legacy of a war, you know, wars that were fought decades ago. The concept of deterrence is kind of an old one.
Good morning, I'm Taylor Wilson, and this is Five Things You Need to Know Friday, the 26th of February, 2021. Today, does the U.S. need its vast overseas military presence, plus the latest on COVID-19 relief, and more? Here are some of the top headlines. Former USA Gymnastics coach John Gettert has died by suicide. His death came after a slew of charges filed against him on Thursday, ranging from human trafficking to sexual assault. He was the former owner of a gymnastics club where hundreds of women and girls said that convicted serial molester Larry Nassar abused them. Nassar is currently serving a 175-year prison sentence. The United States has bombed facilities in Syria. Stay tuned for all the latest. And President Joe Biden is heading to Texas on Friday to assess the damage after a deadly winter storm. The U.S. has a massive overseas military empire. The Department of Defense spends more than $700 billion a year on weapons and combat preparedness. That's more than the next 10 countries combined. 60,000 American military and civilian personnel are stationed in Japan, more than 45,000 in Germany, more than 200,000 around the world in more than 150 countries. And there are up to 800 overseas U.S. military bases. That number might be somewhat inflated since the Pentagon often considers multiple base sites near each other to be separate, but it's still by far the biggest number on Earth. By contrast, China has just one single overseas base, and Britain, France, and Russia have up to 60 bases combined. Threats to the United States are also changing and are increasingly non-military in nature. They include things like cyber attacks, disinformation, and disease outbreaks like COVID-19. So, is America's military overseas less relevant than it once was? International correspondent Kim Helmgard discussed with Stephanie Savelle, a researcher from Brown University's Cost of War project.
If we're going to talk about ending the endless wars, we need to really acknowledge their full scope. I kind of think of an octopus whose head is in the Middle East and who has dozens of tentacles stretching out all across the globe, from the Philippines to Chile to Kenya to Mali. We need to have a serious debate about whether this vast expanse of militaristic activity, we need to really ask, what are the costs of all this? Are we meeting our goals? Are we making Americans safer? Are we helping protect civilians around the world? And if not, what should we be doing instead?
You know, often the counterpoint to this, or the argument that's made about to justify this, is the concept of deterrence. Policymakers, military officials often say, look, well, we need this huge presence. We need to do all these operations, because if we're not kind of forward deployed, if we're not kind of preventative, then ultimately this will kind of come back on us. And I think, at least in terms of the story that we published this week, we kind of show that, well, you know, a lot of these bases that are out there are a legacy of a war, you know, wars that were fought decades ago. The concept of deterrence is kind of an old one, and it hasn't been substantively revisited. To Stephanie's point, it's hard to make that argument in a place like Afghanistan, where there's more violence there, Taliban-related violence there now than there ever was. What is the point of the last 20-odd years in a place like Afghanistan if there's not more democracy in the place, if there's more deaths every day, more and more voices, some voices anyway, are starting to say, like, well, if we have all these bases in Iraq or Afghanistan or Yemen or wherever, often, you know, to Stephanie's point, it creates more terrorists than it kind of gets rid of.
To read Kim's full story, search military bases on usatoday.com. There you can get more insight from experts and see graphics showing data from the story. Beyond the bases themselves, the U.S. continues to carry out military actions, particularly in the Middle East. On Thursday, the United States bombed facilities used by Iranian militant groups suspected of attacking American and allied forces in Iraq last week. The strikes were first authorized by President Joe Biden and hit multiple targets. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Thursday that he was confident the strike hit the intended target.
We're confident in the target that we went after. We know what we hit. And we're confident that that target was being used by the same Shia militia that conducted the strikes.
The Biden administration previously condemned a February 15th rocket attack in Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdish-run region. But as recently as this week, officials had not determined for sure who carried it out. A little-known Shiite group called the Guardians of Blood Brigade took responsibility for the February 15th attack. A rocket attack last week also appeared to target the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. Iran said this week it has no links to the Guardians of Blood Brigade. Under the Trump administration, the U.S. killed top Iranian General Qassem Soleimani last year. Trump had said the death of a U.S. contractor in 2019 would be a red line. The House will vote on President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion COVID relief package on Friday. The Democratic-controlled House is expected to pass the package, though it could face some opposition in the Senate. White House and Congress editor Anna Ashbrenner has more.
There's obviously sort of two schools of thought here. Well, many schools of thought, but the big two are, you know, is this bill too big or is this bill too small? So this bill is $1.9 trillion, and there's some concern that it's too much money. Larry Summers, who is a Democrat and worked in Obama's administration as well as Bill Clinton's, has said, you know, there's worry that if we put this much money back into the economy right now, it's going to cause a spike in inflation that will actually be detrimental for the economy, you know, down the line. The opposite side of that is, you know, people saying there's no risk of going too big here. The needs are so vast and immense in the country that $1.9 trillion actually does do a good job of addressing them. And you've heard Press Secretary Jen Psaki say that from the White House podium, that there isn't a concern of going too big here. So those are the main two schools of thought. And really, it breaks down onto the individual line items, right? So there's money for schools in this bill. There's direct aid for state and local governments. It includes checks to individuals, like we saw last year, for $1,400. And so some of that debate is, okay, should we lower the income limit on who gets the checks? And that pairs off a little bit of the price tag. Should we, you know, cut back a little bit on what we're offering state and local governments? There's some argument that state and local governments could get by with, you know, just more than half of what the bill has for them now. And so really when you're seeing people debate the merits of the bill, it's really more about the merits of individual items. I think there's a consensus that assistance is needed. I think everyone can agree there, and we're all living in our communities and seeing the need. But really the debate is over how much and where is it going.
One provision that won't be in the deal, a $15 minimum wage. The push to raise the federal minimum wage took a key loss on Thursday. Senate parliamentarian Elizabeth McDonough decided the provision would have to be removed and considered a standalone bill or part of other legislation. Meanwhile, the economic fallout from COVID-19 continues, and Americans need help right now. Housing and Social Services reporter Romina Ruiz-Goriena spoke with two Americans who explained how COVID stimulus money would help them in immediate and meaningful ways.
COVID-19 is leaving a trail of losses in its wake. Lost family, lost jobs, lost hope. And one of the most quintessential things that we get to do as reporters is talk with everyday Americans, with our readers, with our viewers, with our listeners, and get as close as possible to the ground to portray an intimate snapshot of what they're facing amid historic unemployment rates, a growing housing crisis, and hunger. Take the case of Tiffany Velez from Vineland, New Jersey, who had to quit her Instacart job to take care of her kids when they were sent home from school, the twins from grade school and her eldest from college. She is averaging $3 per meal per person and is still unable to pay for both food and utilities.
You know, it's kind of a race to get it paid before March when they lift those sanctions. And I don't know what we'll do. We were hoping for that stimulus to get it all caught up.
Now, the House of Representatives could vote as soon as Friday on President Biden's $1.9 trillion relief package. At USA Today, we asked people around the country still suffering from COVID-19's economic fallout how they would spend the $1,400. Many of them told me that lawmakers from both parties at the local and federal level are making decisions that affect them without really knowing the problems that they face daily. Others said that they're falling through and they just are unable to catch up. Misty McDade from West Virginia, who is a gender-based violence survivor who got out of poverty and eventually landed a six-figure job, she accomplished something incredibly rare. She's part of the 4% raised at the bottom rung of the income ladder that made it to the top. Then COVID-19 hit and everything went belly up.
It feels like I failed, even though it wasn't me. I never wanted to put my kids back into a trailer or into something that feels less than.
For them, a stimulus check is more than cash. $1,400 can stave off an eviction or a utility shutoff. It can nurse a teenager back to health, provide seed money for a business, pay for an education, and in some cases, provide a new sense of freedom.
For more of Romina's work, you can follow at Romina Adi on Twitter. A third COVID-19 vaccine in the U.S. is widely expected to get a thumbs up from an FDA advisory committee on Friday. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine has gone through a large clinical trial, just like Moderna and Pfizer's authorized vaccines. The J&J vaccine is just one dose, unlike the two-dose regimens for others. It's shown to be about 66% effective at preventing moderate to severe COVID-19 and about 85% effective against the most serious illness. And as Dr. Paul Offit from Children's Hospital of Philadelphia told the AP, there are certain advantages to the Johnson & Johnson version.
It is refrigerator stable. It can be shipped and stored at refrigerator temperatures. It can, once it gets to the final place where it's going to be administered, it's stable in the refrigerator for 3 months. It's given as a single shot.
The FDA will likely formally grant authorization in the next few days. It's time for this year's Snow Moon. The latest full moon gets its name from Native Americans and others throughout history who have named moons after nature's cues. The snow moon will rise in the east around nightfall on Friday before setting early Saturday morning in the west. About once every 19 years, February has no full moon at all. The last time that happened was in 2018. Thanks for listening to 5 Things. Be sure to subscribe for free, and you can also drop us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. And if you get a sec, you can also leave us a review. Thanks to those of you who have already done so, including Ramblin' Photoger, who told us they enjoyed recent stories on Mars and teaching Black history. A reminder, you can also find us wherever you get your audio, including Spotify. Thanks as always to Claire Thornton and Shannon Green for their work on the show. 5 Things is part of the USA Today Network.
Dr. George Dimitri, medical oncologist, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
Over the past 5 years, 51% of all FDA-approved cancer drugs have had substantial input from Dana-Farber scientists and clinical investigators. And that comes from the culture here, the very basic curiosity-driven scientists that are probing really how cancer works, and then the expert clinicians that interact with patients and families every day. It's not easy to have input at a substantive level to new drugs that are safe and effective at treating cancer. So our whole mantra has always been to try to minimize risks to patients and yet try to maximize the opportunity of finding how effective a new treatment could be. And that means understanding cancer really, really deeply.
At Dana-Farber, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.